greatly than the Centers for Disease Control, which relied on reports from physicians on cases actually treated, predicted the program would bounce back, recalibrated with fresh data. Yet, as of June 2017, Flu Trends was still inactive, and Google was providing only historical data. Meanwhile, a paper published in June 2017 concluded that Google Trends seems to be more influenced by the media clamor than by true epidemiological burden. For Google, the search data represented little or no additional data gathering or storage expense. For academic and government researchers, in the absence of powerful new hardware or ultra-efficient algorithms, access to massive datasets might become prohibitively expensive or might produce misleading conclusions. The efficiency of data acquisition has brought a quiet crisis to biomedical research in particular. Science might, of course, be an exception. Scientists are part of a tightly knit and highly competitive community in which multiple laboratories are racing to solve the same problems, and rewards go disproportionately to priority, a tournament, as economists call it. So it is especially interesting that the inefficient effects of efficient networks also are visible in popular culture. An efficient recommendation system for music, for example, would be one in which the most popular artists were also the ones whom the public judged to show the highest quality, as though by a Darwinian selection of the fittest. The popular music market lets us see the impact of technological efficiency without the complications of prestigious gatekeepers. Enthusiasts of digital culture, like the media studies professor Clay Shirky, compare web technology to Gutenberg's invention of movable type, unleashing some unfortunate excesses, but in the long run, empowering human collaboration and innovation. But while publishers from the 15th century to the 20th often had to guess what the public would want to buy, online publication lets all of us contend for mass attention. Online collaboration by millions of producer consumers of culture will, in this view, be more efficient at recognizing quality than the guesses of powerful intermediaries. The computer scientist Jaron Lanier has deplored the resulting culture of the mashup and the collective mind in preference to rewards for individual talent as digital Maoism. Evgeny Morozov has questioned crowdsourcing enthusiasts' populist disdain for the insights of professional critics whose experience and discernment advance civilization, speculating half-seriously that someday even the collective judgment of crowds will be replaced by algorithms writing reviews of works composed by other algorithms. But even these objections to digital efficiency may overlook a more fundamental defect of technology in aggregating popular taste. It may not be so efficient in reflecting what people really think. Cultural success and failure does have something in common with science, the first-mover advantage. Early publication in a field does not guarantee a prize, and it is possible for a very advanced paper to become a sleeping beauty until its insights are rediscovered. But in general, the physicist M.E.J. Newman has concluded after studying citation patterns, a relatively pedestrian paper on what will become the next year's hottest topic will get more attention than an excellent one on this year's. Once a scientist has early recognition, he or she will continue to accrue further preference and access to resources, which will multiply what might have started as, at best, a slight superiority. Robert K. Merton's Matthew Effect, which we encountered in Chapter 2. Music, literature, and art would seem to have less risk of a Matthew Effect. Equipping and funding a laboratory demands big investments, so people shut out of early opportunities often don't have second chances. The arts may yield few fortunes, but at least have a low cost of entry. Success is up to a broad public, not a relatively small number of senior peers, administrators, and grant committee members, though such humanist authorities can certainly help make careers. Yet the Matthew effect still applies. There is a variety of the first mover advantage when large numbers of people rate and recommend music and other cultural works on the web, according to a study by the sociologists Matthew J. Salganik, Peter Sheridan Dodds, and Duncan J. Watts, published early in the social media era in 2006. The power of personal recommendation had been widely recognized for decades, ever since the first studies of word-of-mouth recommendations at the end of the Second World War. Even after saturation with television commercials, later studies confirmed, people were more influenced in many purchase decisions by friends, relatives, neighbors, and sometimes their doctors. Down to the end of the 20th century, when web reviews began to appear, people discussed choices face-to-face. In the age of the LP and the CD, music store owners and clerks could also affect decisions, if only by their choice of artists and albums to stock. The music department manager of the Princeton University store in the 1980s, for example, was a professional musician who made Baroque CD recordings a specialty. Salganik, Dodds, and Watts set out to see how influence was expressed anonymously and electronically in the web age, including over 14,000 subjects. The researchers' method was to compare how the chain of recommendations and popularity rankings over time compared with the inherent quality of the music, as judged by people in the same sample, not by musicians or critics. If user recommendations and ratings were efficient, popularity of the music should be strongly correlated with judgments of quality by people listening to it, with no other information. In fact, there was a positive relationship between rank and quality. The best music was seldom at the bottom of the scale, and the worst rarely at the top, but it was surprisingly mild. The implication for the authors was that the process of recommendation tends to magnify modest head starts, as we have seen of scientific research, and turn them into a massive cumulative advantage that the public may consider obvious in retrospect, hence the circular definition of celebrity. For most musical works, as for most products, success and failure may be a matter of random fluctuations, in other words, of luck, as Robert H. Frank has argued. This effect did not begin with Amazon ranking or music download sites like iTunes. As Frank notes, it was present even in the face-to-face years. Lists from commercial and tax documents to religious principles like the Ten Commandments are an ancient genre. One of the first written records of Mesopotamia over 4,500 years ago is a list of 120 officials of the city of Uruk. Rankings are much more recent. For example, the ancient Greeks did not even award second and third prizes at their Olympics. Some books were known as sensational sellers, but newspapers did not compare their sales records with others. The lists that they published, beginning in the late Victorian era, were compilations of best books as recommended by cultural authorities. Today's fascination with quantified popularity did not begin until the 1930s. Before that, sales comparisons had been the province of trade journals. For the first time, widely publicized lists claimed to tabulate popular preferences. The New York Times bestseller list, 1931, and the Billboard Hit Parade, 1936. Magazine editors, probably beginning with Clay Felker and New York in the 1970s, began to add subjective lists like 10 best restaurants to their cover stories. With increasing competition for shrinking newsstand space since the 1990s, and with readers feeling pressed for time, lists have become an indispensable promise of easy-to-digest information for short attention spans. Listicles are so ubiquitous, online as well as in print, that the phenomenon is seldom discussed anymore. The media psychologist Stuart Fischoff called them pre-digested food for thought when we haven't had the time to keep up, but are nonetheless hungry to keep pace. It's in the web version of publications, though, that ranked lists thrive most vigorously. The Atlantic's senior editor, Derek Thompson, has reported that after viewing an article, a reader's most frequent second click is not one of the featured new stories, but the cumulative list of most popular ones, despite the list's location at a bottom corner of the page. The cumulative advantage of even an obsolescent article may persist for years, Thompson acknowledges, but the practice is too beneficial for The Atlantic's own ranking and advertising income to stop. The power of top 10 lists and ranking goes beyond newspapers and magazines to the entire web. It is true that Amazon, Apple, iTunes, and other platform companies do a lot of profitable business with works selling relatively few copies, the long tail of distribution that Chris Anderson has made famous. Collectively, these sell more copies than all the books on bestseller lists, especially because many of them are steady sellers, while some extremely popular books fade rapidly. Still, the attention given to the very top sellers magnifies the effects noted by Salganik, Dodds, and Watts, turning small initial advantages into bonanzas that then appear due entirely to the quality of the books themselves. The same is true of music and smartphone software. As the economist Matthew Jackson expressed it, being 11th on a top 10 list on the App Store is a lot different than being 10th on that list. When we survey the effect of algorithms on information, news, and culture, the positive side of efficiency can't be denied. Even after the spread of paywalls and the closing and retrenchment of valuable publications, readers around the world have access to an unprecedented range of sources without charge. Wikipedia may be imperfect and may fall far short of the ideal inclusive community of readers/editors, but it is vastly superior to conventional encyclopedias in its ability to link rapidly to new sources. Science citation indexing gives researchers an overview of their fields far superior to anything available in the age of printed references. Plagiarism may be more efficient, but so is its detection. Social media may be a waste of time and shadow work for the corporations that profit from their users' data, but also a remarkably efficient way to share sources and ideas rapidly. Cultural authorities in the alleged golden ages of culture from the 1890s through the 1950s deplored the trends of their times as much as their successors do today. Nostalgia is misplaced. If, however, we compare the present not with a sentimentalized past, but with the promise and potential of information technology, the picture is darker. Search engine algorithms have evolved to use artificial intelligence techniques like machine learning, a challenge for corporations and celebrities paying for search engine optimization, SEO consultants who can boost their rankings. Those who can't afford such services may be at a disadvantage. Personalization of content may not be the absolute filter bubble that some critics fear, but it can take special efforts to see the strongest arguments opposing a user's point of view. Advertising rewarded by user clicks seems to be more personalized, but promotes teasing and sensationalism that would probably be rejected by the same publication's print advertising departments. Most seriously, the efficiency of social media algorithms has diverted vital advertising revenue from publications themselves to platform companies, an obvious effect in retrospect, but one that few editors and publishers seem to have foreseen until well into the web era. Adapting to the new environment requires dedicated staff to monitor reader engagement and optimize content for search and social media. This additional overhead is the opposite of the friction-free world promised by The Road Ahead in 2005. Technology enthusiasts may protest that it is simply more efficient for journalistic talent to migrate to sites like BuzzFeed and Vox, which have in fact improved their content. But most of their writers still depend on other sources for their facts, just as Wikipedia editors do. Wikipedia even has a ban against editors including original research in their work on articles. The only truly efficient thing about the new mobile-oriented information machine is the ability of platform companies to claim an ever higher share of revenue, and in the long term, threatening the media they depend on. In the centuries of continuous process technology, it was manufacturers, refiners, and distributors who seemed to have excessive power over information. From the 1980s to the onset of the 2008 recession, progressive critics of media like Ben Bagdikian and Noam Chomsky saw corporate conglomerates and their allies, corporate advertisers, as a threat to democracy through their oligopoly and alleged censorship of news. Meanwhile, conservative critics like the publisher William Rusher and the columnist Jonah Goldberg perceived a cadre of staunch liberals opposed to the values of owners and public alike. And the two apparently contradictory views were in a way compatible. When print advertising was by today's standards lavish, building readership and thus revenue was more important than advancing a political agenda. Neither Google nor the newly founded Facebook appears in the index of the second edition of Bagdikian's Media Monopoly, published in 2004. But the loss of advertising revenue to platform companies that produce limited content themselves makes the old debate moot. And as we have heard, digital startup sites have been experiencing some of the same anxiety about advertising revenue as legacy publications. Newspapers, magazines, and web-only sites face different versions of the same challenge. The press, as we know it, was born in the 1880s and 1890s, when a handful of publishers like the newspaper barons Joseph Pulitzer, William Randolph Hearst, and Adolph S. Ox, and magazine innovators like S.S. McClure realized that mass circulation and advertising could reinforce each other. Quality could actually improve as prices were lowered and sales and advertising revenues grew. This model survived the Great Depression. Fortune magazine, a corporate showcase, was profitable despite its then astronomical newsstand price of $1. The Second World War, television, September 11, and even the first decade of the web. Media are cobbling together a new future with digital-only publication, a short-term solution at best, reductions in staff and frequency of publication, and higher subscription prices, resulting in an older, if richer, readership. The more efficient journalism has become, the less viable it appears to be. There is one remaining question, an obvious one. Social media advertising and programs like Google's AdSense, unlike AdWords, it depends not on a user's search, but on the content of a web page and data on the user, including his or her location, promise the utopia of advertisers, efficient targeting of the best prospects. People are understandably concerned about use of their private data by marketers, and fear the omniscience of platforms like Facebook and Twitter. But does social media advertising work? Is it effective as well as efficient? This might be an unfair question. Michael Schutzen showed in his classic 1980s study that it is usually impossible to document what advertising accomplishes. Data-driven, personalized web advertising promised to be different, and it does give advertisers much more accurate data about how many times their announcements have been seen. The role of advertising in actual decisions, apart from direct web sales, is harder to trace, at least according to a study published by Gallup in 2014. Only 5% of Americans said social media marketing has a great deal of influence on their buying decisions, 30% said some influence, and fully 62% said no influence. Among millennials, reports of moderate influence were higher, 43%, but there was little difference in the number reporting high influence, only 7%. As with all self-reported behavior, these numbers are open to question. People may be more or less influenced than they recall or are willing to acknowledge. Of course, the same may be true of print advertising and of website advertising sold directly by publications. AdSense serves AdWords advertising mainly to smaller sites. For larger online publishers, a Google subsidiary called DoubleClick and its program DoubleClick for Publishers matches larger online publications and advertisers. The details are too complex for those not directly concerned, just as television viewers who did not subscribe to advertising journals did not generally know how commercials were created and placed. The difference is the impressive precision and monitoring that Google can achieve, and its dominant position as a platform-based matchmaker with proprietary algorithms and access to far more data than it reveals. One website owner, Josh Marshall, of the news site Talking Points Memo, TPM, made his feelings clear in a September 2017 article, A Serf on Google's Farm. Google's monopoly is comically great, reinforced by its ownership of the Chrome browser. While, unlike Facebook, it has shared millions of dollars with TPM, it has also created a sense of dependency. Crucially, Google is not an especially efficient master. For example, Marshall reports, his site's accounts of the mass murderer Dylan Roof led to warnings about the possible classification of TPM as a hate site. There was no noticeable loss of income from this or other Google false alarms, but probably because of its monopoly standing, Google had little incentive to improve its screening software, with stress and loss of time for the publisher. It is thus possible that what appear to be permanent shifts based on hard data are neither more nor less than fashions based on intuition, and that native advertising may yet return to newspapers and magazines. By supporting high-quality publications, along with more questionable ones, it is true, advertising can show the positive side of inefficiency. It's possible that a new generation of advertising buyers will rediscover the kind of institutional advertising that has gone out of fashion, affirming rather than trying to defeat the underlying uncertainty of advertising. But I must admit, the outlook for such support is dark now. At the end of 2016, the Wall Street Journal made major cuts to its print edition and editorial staff after declines in advertising revenue. While there is already evidence that the power of online advertising has been exaggerated, Procter & Gamble withdrew $100 million from its budget in summer 2017 and claimed the effect on sales was negligible, the company's example has so far not been followed. Regarding search, even one of the platform giants is rethinking speed. Jamie Tivan, a researcher at Microsoft, has written a paper with academic colleagues reconsidering users' apparent demand for almost instantaneous search results. The computing public has come to equate speed with efficiency. In fact, as Tivan et al. Observe, the rapid answers we expect may not be the best that the search engine could provide if given more time. If search engines were allowed minutes rather than fractions of a second, they could get answers to more complex questions that today lead to dead ends. They could also see results presented in more useful ways. The Tivan paper makes the important point that we often mistake electronic speed for efficiency because we have not experienced higher quality results from slower and deeper searches. Koreans are even willing to pay for a texting-based service that transmits queries to many other subscribers for answers. Tomorrow's search engine interfaces will offer the option of deeper and more complex searches that will be more truly efficient in yielding the most useful answers and might even have an element of serendipity built in. There are even services that attempt to offer algorithm-curated serendipity. They work by combining users' lists of their own interests, their likes and dislikes of pages they are shown, and the reaction of other users who share their interests and tastes. But these offerings can be only as absorbing as the publishers and websites who have agreed to share their content. StumbleUpon, for example, shows me mostly listicles rather than meatier articles from major science review journals. There are also many striking, no doubt Photoshop-enhanced images. So far, at least, I can get more consistently serendipitous links by subscribing to individual publications and writers on Twitter. I find Flipboard the most promising, since in addition to its own algorithm's recommendations, there's an opportunity to comment and to follow individuals. The mobile graphic user interface is even better than Facebook's and Twitter's. Flipboard in itself does not do much to solve the problem of paying for original writing, but it shows that algorithms can be used to broaden knowledge rather than to make it too narrowly personalized. Turning back to the citation-driven world of science, Flipboard illustrates how suggestions might work on a more advanced professional level, helping identify possibly neglected papers, keeping track of new techniques in mathematics and data analysis. Newspapers and magazines with longer backfiles could also offer exploration and suggestion tools to their paying subscribers, making it easier to study trends and themes over time and to rediscover older ideas that may be relevant again. We are still at an early stage in the development of discovery and suggestion software. It took over 2 decades for the elegance of Google's PageRank algorithm to supplement the basic search options of pre-web databases like LexisNexis. Despite this promise, it would be a mistake to rely entirely on algorithms to remedy distortion by other algorithms. We must continue to make room for analog learning. Algorithms can sometimes find hidden possibilities, as in spotting undervalued athletes or exploring unfamiliar lines of chess openings, but they can also easily become self-reinforcing, closing off promising alternatives that human intuition can recognize as intriguing. And they may leave organizations surprisingly vulnerable. If a decade of experience shows that a certain background set of traits are ideally matched to a job, and algorithms consistently screen applicants accordingly, short-term results may be impressive. But the price of success may be an organizational culture that is ill-suited for new conditions and generations calling for different qualifications, or at least a different mix of backgrounds. Algorithms, while usually regarded as technologies of the future, can tell us only about the past, including trends that may be reversed. There are many applications in which analog technologies are indeed dead. But there is a kind of serendipity that comes from engagement with analog media, just as vinyl recordings have recovered modestly despite electronic downloads and streaming. The reason may be partly the superior sound of analog, but that is not the whole story. If audiophile opinion ruled, there would be a strong market for vinyl records of classical music, but their resale value remains low. It is the pleasure of rummaging through used recordings for discoveries that helps sustain remaining shops like the Princeton Record Exchange, which reports 600 visitors daily and double that on weekends. It is not that we are going back to LP records. It is that analog sound is a different way to listen to music, inefficient to produce, distribute, and listen to, but still a potentially illuminating experience. In the next chapter, we will hear that the principle of a serendipitous analog reserve applies not just to the adult information economy, but to schools and higher education at all levels. By refusing to follow efficiency at all costs, we can become both more efficient and more effective. Chapter 3. The Mirage of the Teaching Machine. Why Learning is Still a Slog After 50 Years of Moore's Law. Hopes for efficiency through information technology have been greatest of all, not in the news media, the scientific publications, or the everyday search queries we considered in the last chapter, but in education. More than 40 years after the arrival of affordable home and educational computing, schools still are labor-intensive. In 2013, there were over 5 million teachers in America at all levels. Continuing a trend that had begun around 1900, the national pupil-teacher ratio continued to decline in the early computer years of the 1970s and 1980s. After a slight rise, it was still about 16 to 1 in 2012, less than half what it had been in the days of J.P. Morgan. Most lay people, as well as educators, considered the lower ratio an improvement rather than a loss of productivity. By contrast, farmers were once almost 40% of the U.S. population and now are 2%. Teaching continues to be a relatively inefficient process, despite efforts among some of the most brilliant thinkers in education, psychology, and computing, as well as the rise of machine learning and self-driving automobiles. Nor has there been significant improvement in most test scores since the computer's advent. That does not mean that information technology is useless in education, quite the contrary. It can amplify the efficiency and effectiveness of well-trained teachers. But where teachers are underqualified and hardware and software resources are underfunded, there is evidence that a little computer power may be more of a distraction, a temptation to excessive video game playing, than an aid to learning. Far from an afterthought or a 1970s trend, a technological revolution in education has been a high priority for entrepreneurs since the early electric age. It was a favorite project of America's premier technologist of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Thomas Edison, who promoted mechanical instruction as an application of his motion picture patents. Edison claimed in 1922 that current textbooks functioned at only 2% efficiency. "The education of the future, as I see it," he continued, "will be conducted through the medium of the motion picture, a visualized education, where it should be possible to obtain 100% efficiency." He never defined what 100% efficiency would mean in education. Presumably, he was convinced that with the best audiovisual materials, the same knowledge could be acquired in 1/50th of the time. And in 1925, he followed up by predicting that by 1935, textbooks as the principal medium of teaching will be as obsolete as the horse and carriage are now. There is no limitation to the camera. Edison believed so strongly in this future that he invested significant money in it and lost, according to his biographer Paul Israel. Originally a self-taught telegrapher, a member of the original geek culture of electromechanical tinkerers, Edison valued university science and recruited trained graduates as his assistants. For all his futurist optimism, he maintained a Victorian middle-class Protestant passion for moral uplift amid the sensationalist and racy fare offered by so many Nickelodeon exhibitors to their plebeian spectators. To bypass the exhibitors and appeal to domestic, church, and especially school audiences, Edison had even invented a new film projection system, the Home Projecting Kinetoscope, or Home PK, introduced in 1912. Using new, non-flammable film stock in a fireproof enclosure, The film and projector were ingeniously designed to show a standard 1,000-foot reel on only 77 feet of film, using an aperture that shifted when one strip of the film reached its end and reversed. Edison planned to sell 10,000 of these machines through his corporation, but believed in the new medium so strongly that he funded the educational content personally. As they would be for other educational efficiency experiments in the decades to come, early newspaper reports were enthusiastic, if only because of Edison's heroic stature in American industry, and press releases giving memorable copy to harried journalists. One article declared, "Thomas Edison has finished his job of illuminating the world. Now he is engaged on an invention to illuminate the mind." For all the wizard's charisma, though, teachers and administrators were cautious and rejected the idea that the new technology could displace their roles and methods. They made the valid point that the films, while illustrating scientific and engineering principles and created by Edison's expert laboratory staff, did not fit teachers' needs. Few of the 16,000 school superintendents ordered from the catalog Edison sent them, and Edison soon shut down the program. In hindsight, the problem was apparent. Instead of working with teachers and addressing their classroom challenges, Edison evidently believed his prestige would lead educators to revise their curricula around his catalog. Edison had a deeper problem that would continue to haunt many other efficiency movements. In thinking about education, he refused to accept how much inefficiency and waste are often necessary to create something efficient. After all, Edison himself was already famous for remarks about genius, inspiration, and perspiration, and especially for his persistence in mastering the details that made electric lighting economically feasible. Edison had boasted, "I can teach more accurate geography in half an hour to a class of young pupils by moving pictures than a pedagogue can in a month. The moving picture art will largely supplement the art of printing for the transmission and diffusion of knowledge." Yet while Edison had no geographic education of his own, he was not prepared to spend months or even years with geography teachers creating films that would teach the subject more efficiently than conventional lectures and books. He underrated the time and money needed to create a successful product by orders of magnitude. And this was not just because he was unfamiliar with instruction. He was making similar mistakes in imposing efficiency as a film producer. When overseas revenue declined during the First World War, Edison retained an efficiency expert and decreed a shooting ratio of 4-3, use of 3/4 of all film shot, a policy that demanded mostly single takes. In the 1990s, late in the celluloid era, a low ratio in Hollywood was 15-1. Other producers learned that creativity often demands waste and made their peace with the star system and salaries Edison deemed extravagant. As educational films became more widely available with sound and 16mm projectors in the 1930s, studies showed that while films did have promise in motivating students, as Edison had predicted, they were hardly an economy measure. To the contrary, they could do little on their own. Teachers had to be specially prepared to use them. They could make education more effective, but they demanded equal or greater resources to do that, a lesson more recently repeated with each generation of computer technology. The real future of technological efficiency would have to wait until the end of the Second World War and the rise of the stored program computer. Its underlying concepts were much older, even predating Edison's home PK. In An Introduction to His Field, published in 1912, the pioneering psychologist Edward L. Thorndike proposed the concept of a book that would let the student move to a new page only after he or she had demonstrated understanding of the previous one. An idea finally realized As the entrepreneur and educational computing historian Brian Deer has observed, by the World Wide Web and its ability to link pages. After Thorndike and Edison, academic computing branched in two directions. The great pioneer of teaching programming to undergraduates, Dartmouth's John Kameny, was not efficiency-minded at all. He approached computing as an enhancement of education, not as a substitute for teaching. An American of cultivated Central European background, like MIT's Norbert Wiener, he saw computing as the latest and most promising academic resource. Kameny co-developed the BASIC programming language that helped launch personal computing. But there was a second and more pragmatic strain of reform that rekindled Edison's dream, the psychologist B.F. Skinner's idea that learning could be accelerated by carefully planned rewards and individual feedback. Unlike the free spirits of educational technology, Seymour Papert and Marvin Minsky, who experimented with new computer languages to empower children's creativity, Skinner was an unreconstructed admirer of industrial ways. He deliberately chose the phrase teaching machines with its blue-collar connotations, and did not hesitate to make claims for productivity in terms Edison and Henry Ford would have approved. His projects with would-be manufacturers failed. He thought electromechanically and was isolated from the already flourishing personal computing scene. Yet despite his disappointments, he could not help returning to the idea. In 1984, the same year in which Apple's Super Bowl commercial for the Macintosh promised liberation of the individual from authoritarianism, Skinner published a broadside, The Shame of American Education, in American Psychologist. He made bold claims for educational efficiency, twice the learning with half the effort. The method was programmed learning built into consoles that presented information in small steps, followed by questions that in effect were instant quizzes. Students could learn systematically at their own pace, being rewarded immediately as they grasped each essential concept. The Smithsonian's National Museum of American History has preserved one of Skinner's original teaching machines, a wooden box the size of a large briefcase with slots displaying questions from rotating paper discs and rolls of adding machine-style tape on which students were to write answers. After the student responded and advanced the tape, the correct answer would appear in the slot. Over decades, other educational psychologists developed more sophisticated electromechanical and electronic variants. Trying to teach an entire class at a time, even a tracked class, was wasted effort, Skinner and his followers believed. So was expecting children to discover the principles of mathematics and other subjects on their own. The most efficient way to make new discoveries was to reach competence as rapidly as possible through individualized tutorials, ancestors of the adaptive learning now on the frontier of educational technology research. Teaching machines, as a review also in American Psychologist 4 years later revealed, originated in the 19th century, well before Skinner's birth. But the movement seemed to have reached a dead end by 1988. The fear of an Orwellian generation of robot-like children sitting passively in wholly automated classrooms has not come to pass, wrote a fellow academic psychologist, Ludy Benjamin Jr. Today children spend much of their time staring at a screen, but it belongs to their televisions, not their computers. The rising cognitive psychology movement, Skinner's bête noire, shunned programmed learning as potentially harmful. The University of Illinois' Plato tutoring system, using advanced plasma screens and a military-developed form of programmed learning distinct from Skinner's, grew from self-paced instruction in the 1960s to become the first global social network and the seedbed of the video game industry. One major computer manufacturer, Control Data Corporation, invested over $600 million in the project, which promised to reduce educational costs and improve quality. Yet, independent evaluation found happy users but few benefits, and Plato did not survive the transition to personal computers, Macs, and the web. During the 1980s, too, Apple Computer began a $25 million experimental project, Apple Classrooms of Tomorrow, ACOT, bringing the latest technology to selected schools across the United States. It did not aim to make teaching more efficient by substituting computers for teachers or by reducing the time needed for learning. It was high-tech instructional support, bankrolled in part by the Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, rather than disruptive innovation. The Edison project of the Tennessee advertising entrepreneur Chris Whittle was really Edison's home projecting kinetoscope as a daily cable television program with commercials. These and other projects share an initial wave of publicity, a quiet winding down, and a series of evaluations that let the sponsors claim victory while skeptics deny improvement over conventional instruction. Government, corporate, and foundation sponsorship comes and goes. Most entrepreneurs, as usual, fail, with even outstanding products like the Voyager CD-ROMs we encountered in the last chapter apparently unplayable on current computers. This cycle contrasts with the genuine disruption, for better or worse, of the dominant platform companies: Apple's iTunes, Amazon's Kindle Reader, Google Book Search, Facebook, Twitter, and others. All these have scaled, grown steadily and globally by orders of magnitude, while the kind of adaptive learning Skinner envisioned, with constant tutorial feedback and personalized electronic coaching, has not been realized. Why did Control Data Corporation spin itself off bit by bit instead of becoming the Amazon.com of education? It sold Plato in 1989, and the program's ultimate incarnation, while profitable for the British publishing conglomerate Pearson as recently as 2008, did not survive the recession that struck soon thereafter. Why are so many educational experiments half-forgotten footnotes, while other high-technology dreams have become realities? One answer is that individualized tutorial education might still work, vindicating the pioneers. The original researchers are often so influential that they are paradoxically forgotten as others develop their ideas. Robert K. Merton saw a similar pattern in Science Citations as obliteration by incorporation, OBI. While Xerox Corporation has survived, its role in developing the graphic interface that inspired the Macintosh is also known mainly to industry veterans and enthusiasts. Before Brian Deer's History of Plato, even fewer people were aware of the University of Illinois' electronic engineering genius Donald Bitzer, who developed the system and its striking original orange plasma terminal screens. Another possible answer is that we are too early. Breakthroughs in the near future could finally bring technological efficiency to education. Tutoring systems might someday learn from student mistakes and adapt to clarifying subjects, just as machine learning enabled the computer AlphaGo to defeat one of the strongest human players of the ancient Japanese game Go, one in which human masters once seemed able to retain their edge over brute computational force for many years after Deep Blue defeated Garry Kasparov at chess in 1997. It's possible that tomorrow's computers will be able to work with human learning styles better than the best teachers can. Of course, it is equally possible that this turns out to be one of those tasks so complex that no efficient algorithm exists for it. If there is a breakthrough, though, it will be expensive. CDC had real success in employee technical training in aviation and other industries, and government agencies with ample budgets. Its courseware was disappointing in quality and ill-matched to academic needs. William Norris, CDC's autocratic founder and CEO, failed to heed administrators' objections to his system's high costs because he believed CDC could ultimately take over the schools. Nevertheless, for all the hundreds of millions of dollars he had invested in Plato, an investigation by the Minneapolis Tribune in 1982 revealed that students enjoyed it, but did not learn more from it than from conventional instruction. When journalists talk about machines beating people, they are really describing the work of teams of skilled professionals, including human masters and grandmasters, defeating other human experts through the mediation of an algorithm and of stored databases like books of chess openings. Machine learning algorithms, which let computers recognize patterns and experiment with techniques, improving performance with time, need programming too, even though new tools have brought them within the reach of non-experts. And the challenge of the efficiency of educational technology has been all along not a theoretical impossibility, but economic reality. In a report published by the Russell Sage Foundation in 1995, as ACOT was shutting down, the psychologist and computer scientist Earl Hunt explained why teacher-centered technology, enhancing traditional instruction but not necessarily making it more efficient in Edison's sense, was prevailing over intelligent computer-assisted instruction, ICAI, closer to the Skinner conception. The demands of ICAI for highly skilled development teams were no match for the constraints of school budgets. Hunt might have added the limited staying power and shifting focus of corporate and foundation support. As the cost of computer power drops, he cautioned, the computer programs become ever more sophisticated. Expensive non-teaching personnel are always a target for the public budget cutter. Despite new initiatives by the Clinton administration and technology executives in the 1990s, skepticism remained. It did not help that students' expectations of production values had grown with the release of games like the Grand Theft Auto series. By 2011, a New York Times reporter, Matt Richtel, visited a school district that had approved a substantial tax increase for a technology-intensive program, only to find no measurable difference in standardized test scores and lower budgets for other school programs. Yet the pro-technology educational reform movement has historically favored testing and objective metrics, so advocates can hardly claim that there are intangible benefits the tests do not measure, although good software may improve outcomes in long-term retention or in continuing interest in a subject. Beginning in the early 2010s, high-technology education reformers started shifting their attention from the long-sought utopian goal of the self-paced adaptive learning machine to the efficiency and effectiveness of conventional classroom instruction. Related to the electronic medical records movement that we will examine in Chapter 5, have been efforts to put big data in the service of improving and individualizing instruction in conventional classroom settings. The best known has been a project called In Bloom, sponsored by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which received a total of $100 million, mostly from participating state school systems, according to the Washington Post education writer Valerie Strauss. In Bloom was intended to compile massive databases of student performance that could be analyzed to improve individual instruction and give teachers a better sense of their effectiveness. The organization had the misfortune of launching at a time when privacy concerns, always a serious point in educational computing, were continuing to grow as the accounts of 77 million Sony PlayStation users were hacked. Impatience with centralized bureaucracies was already apparent across the political spectrum. The Gates Foundation made even more controversial grants in 2011 and 2012 for a pilot program using wrist monitor bracelets to measure students' galvanic skin response to give teachers feedback on the level of engagement in their classes. Even the principal investigator, Chandra Daly, an electrical engineer and computer scientist, and entrepreneur specializing in instructional technology, rather than a primary or secondary school teacher, acknowledged that readings could not tell whether a student was engaged or just anxious, or discover whether a student was bored or just relaxed. As in the case of In Bloom, the Gates Foundation should have foreseen opposition. It is one thing to gather statistics, another to record and store children's inferred emotional states. It has not helped the Gates Foundation's cause that the bracelets measured perspiration using a principle familiar from lie detectors. Teachers, too, were not reassured by Daly's acknowledgement that despite her intentions and the Foundation's clarification of its original wording of the grant announcement, the data could be used to judge their performance. Thus, the movement for educational efficiency and individualized instruction through gathering and analyzing massive data sets reached an apparent impasse by the mid-2010s. Education researchers will probably revive the concept, but they are likely to face the same obstacles. Pre-college education, like politics, is local. Each school has its own environment and culture, and often more than one. Reformers tend to impose a uniform grid on diverse circumstances and parental and student cultures without recognizing that local conditions may demand different strategies in implementing changes. This neglect of how organizations really work led to the abandonment of Taylorism in its original form and remains a risk in 21st century efficiency movements. Meanwhile, on the instructional side, new web-based initiatives continue to appear, especially video tutorials. But these face dilemmas of their own. What makes individualized, efficient instruction especially difficult and potentially expensive is that few experts are able to see the world as novices do, an effect that economists and psychologists call the curse of knowledge. I discovered it when I taught a seminar course in the history of information as a visiting lecturer. My syllabus and reading list seemed good to the faculty committee, and a scholarly association even reprinted it. But while some students with strong backgrounds in history loved the course, others, including those from science and engineering whose participation I had welcomed, rightly found that I was assuming too much. Brain scans even suggest that the thinking processes of learners and professionals are physiologically different. Physics students and instructors may actually see different phenomena in the same computer simulation, and many students come to interpret their subjects as a set of rules to be memorized, instead of a deep intuition. Overcoming this tendency, making education efficient in the sense of imparting better skills and more knowledge in less time, cannot itself be done efficiently. It takes many hours of experimentation to find what is effective. The first time an original course is taught is likely to be a beta version. These obstacles have not stopped educators and philanthropists from pursuing colorful web-based reincarnations of Edison's and Skinner's clunky devices, and even Plato's elegant plasma touchscreens of the 1970s and 1980s. One of these, a mathematics teaching program called Dreambox Learning, uses artificial intelligence to customize supplementary lessons with techniques inspired by video games, complete with individual avatars that can accumulate points with successful completion of units. Its patron, Reed Hastings, chief executive of the video platform Netflix, believes that the kind of individualized recommendation software that built his company can also transform learning. Skinner would surely be astounded that the program records 50,000 data points for each student every hour, capturing not just answers, as Skinner's tape did, but each minute step taken in arriving at them. Thanks in part to Hastings' support, 2 million students were using DreamBox Learning in 2017, and parents and teachers say that many cannot get enough of it. As with Plato, evaluators are not sure what DreamBox has added to conventional instruction. The head of DreamBox, Jesse Woolley Wilson, found it especially encouraging that an independent study had at least shown that her program hadn't harmed student progress.